Here's what's coming up on today's episode of Your Tagline Here.
But at 21, I went to the Children's Society, which is where this Sue worked in London.
Okay.
To find out about my mum. Like, why? How did she die? What was her circumstances? Who was she? Tell me more, because I'm now old enough to find out. And that meeting changed my life.
Oh, wow.
That was a very big turning point.
Hello, my name's Simon Tomlinson, and welcome to the seventh episode of Your Tagline Here. This is a weekly podcast sharing real stories from real people. Each week, I'll interview a new guest to find out who they are and what their story is. And at the end of every episode, I'll be asking the guest to provide their tagline for the episode to summarise their story into a short sentence that we can all remember it by. If you enjoyed the episode, then please do give us a like and hit the subscribe button so you don't miss out on any future content. Also, if you have any questions for myself or today's guest, then you can leave them in the comments if you're watching on YouTube, or you can send an email to hello@yourtaglinehere.com. Our guest for this episode is Donna Joseph, who is a very multi-talented person. She's an author, podcaster, radio DJ, coach, and children's entertainer. I met Donna several years ago at a public speaking workshop, and we then became friends, and we used to run a mindfulness group together. She's here today to talk about her experience being adopted as a child and the impact that this had on her life, and also how she found her biological family, which I'm sure is going to be a fascinating and emotional story. Before we speak to Donna, I would just like to mention our sponsor, KitLab, who is a digital marketing company based in Birmingham in the UK. KitLab have over 15 years experience and specialise in branding, websites, search engine optimization, paid advertising, social media and more. So if you want to grow your business online, just head over to kitlab.com, which is KIKLAB.com. Okay, I'd like to now give a very warm welcome to Donna Joseph. Hello, Donna.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Welcome to the podcast. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me here.
And yeah, I'm really excited and intrigued to find out more about your story. So to start with, can you just tell us about how you actually found out that you were adopted as a child, and how old were you?
So I was 3 months old when I was adopted, so I don't remember anything. And my mum fostered children. She adopted me, and then she was just about to start a road of fostering. So I was adopted. And then by the time I was 4 or 5 years old, there was lots of other children. And my mum, because I asked her, when did I find out? I can't remember being physically told. And she said there was a time that she remembers. I was in the garden with one of my foster brothers, and we were singing a song. And I was singing, "I am adopted," and he was singing, "I am fostered." And she said she thinks we were about 3 or 4 years old. So okay. It was something that I always knew.
Yeah,
I always knew that I was adopted. All the other children knew that they were fostered. And the one boy that was their own son knew that he was their own son. So We just always knew, that we were all a bit different, but it was okay. So it was great.
And that's quite nice in a way, that it wasn't just you. There were other children there that were in a similar situation. And I understand that it was a little bit different for you because of your race compared to the other people in the family.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that was the hard bit. That was the fact that I was black, mixed race, and everyone else was white. I mean, one of my foster brothers is Hungarian, so he was slightly tanned.
Okay.
But he had straight hair. His hair was, what I would say at the time, normal. You know, my hair wasn't normal, didn't seem normal. My skin colour didn't seem normal.
Mm.
So from quite a young age, I felt different. And that was hard.
Yeah, it must have been tough being with people who were very different to you. I'm sure that they were very loving, but when you don't feel like you really fit in. So how did that make you feel?
Well, in the home, it was fine. So at home, it was brilliant because we were all different. You know, we were all from different places. We were all there and we all had fun. You imagine a home with just loads of children. We had a playroom, so we just played like kids should play.
Mm.
It was outside of the home. So it was when I started going to school.
Okay.
And I remember now looking back that I didn't like school. And I wonder now whether that was because I didn't feel I fitted in at school. I really didn't feel very comfortable outside of this home environment where there was obvious love and joy. And it didn't matter what, you know, I could have been an alien in there. And it wouldn't have mattered because there was love and joy and it was fine. But when you're outside, I used to have a lot of problems with my hair.
Okay.
So my hair was out of control and it would just grow. And I wouldn't know how to do anything with it.
Okay.
And my mom didn't know either because she wasn't told or taught anything about my culture. Mm. It wasn't her fault. You know, looking back, she now says, if only I'd have been told and I could have taught you about or known what to do, but she didn't.
Mm.
So sadly, I went through my childhood feeling very alone and wanting to belong. And wishing that there were, I remember I used to ask my mom, can you please foster another child the same colour as me?
Aww.
Because then I wouldn't feel like it was just me.
Yeah. So were you quite open about it with your parents and with the rest of your family about how you felt?
Not really.
Okay.
No, not really. I think that was probably the closest I got to it. I think a lot of stuff that used to go on with me, which we'll talk about, was all in my own little head. I used to daydream a lot about what I wanted. I don't think I used to voice that out much. I do remember definitely asking Mom if she could foster more children the same colour as me.
Okay.
But I don't remember it, you know, shouting out about it. That all happened later on in my teens. As a child, I think I just used to... I still think I was quite lonely, really. I felt, you know, I didn't have loads of friends. I remember a scenario at school, and I was in infant school, and it was my first experience of cold custard on pudding. I don't know if you've ever experienced that going down, and it was. But what I really remember about that is like being in absolute shock about what is it going down my throat. But looking around, and what I remember is there was no one else there. So I wonder now, like, why was I sat on my own at the dinner table at school? Where were all my friends? Did I have any friends? I don't think I had many friends.
Okay.
And I wonder whether that was them or me, because I may have been feeling quite lonely and, you know, head down sort of thing. Or I don't think children pick up on colour at that age. I'd like to think that they don't, but who knows? I was on my own at the dinner table that time, and I wonder whether that, who knows why that was.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. It's not something that I've really thought about before. I would guess that children don't see the colour of people's skin, because I think that that's almost like a learned behaviour that people, well, fortunately now things are changing, but in the past that's something that was part of the culture. Yeah. Maybe it's a learned behaviour as children get older. But then people do kind of gravitate towards people that are similar to themselves as well, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
So being the odd one out, I guess, must have been difficult growing up.
It was hard.
So what were your dreams when you were a young child? Because you mentioned that a moment ago, that you had a very vivid imagination. What were the things that you were dreaming about?
This is a big part of my story, because my dreams were, so on the TV, the only other black face that I can remember now, and I definitely dreamed about this, was Fluella Benjamin. So she's a children's entertainer. She still does it now. She reads children's books now, years later. And I used to want to be like her. I used to want to be like Fluella Benjamin on the TV. So I don't know whether it was because she was black that she inspired me, or whether she was a children's entertainer that inspired me, or whether it was on the TV.
Yeah.
But for me, it was a combination of all three. And I used to imagine being like her. I used to daydream about having lots more brothers and sisters the same colour as me.
Okay.
So, you know, the Cosby Show?
Yeah.
So that used to be on then.
Okay.
It shows my age. And I used to wish that I was part of that family. I used to daydream about being that on that family, in that family.
So if I'm just on a bit of a tangent now, if you could go back, would you prefer? Would you have preferred to have been adopted into a black family?
No.
Okay.
Looking back now, I recognise the love, the foundation of unconditional love that I had in that home, that we all had. And I wouldn't swap that for anything now.
Okay.
At the time, you know, I thought I wanted to, but looking back now, absolutely not. The love is more important than anything.
Yeah, definitely. And the fact that you were getting that love and that unconditional love, and you did have a nice family environment that you were growing up in, is the most important thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So when was it that you decided that you wanted to actually find your biological family?
So as I got older, and I think starting to come into adolescence, probably about 11, 12 years old, I became desperate to find my real birth mom, my birth mom. I wanted to, one of the dreams I used to have is I used to dream what she looked like.
Okay.
So I used to have lots of daydreams and use my imagination. I knew she was white. So I used to imagine her with blonde hair.
Okay.
And I said this in a talk that maybe that is because I wished I'd had blonde hair. Mm. I don't know. I didn't want my hair at the time. and this, it became more of an obsession as I got to the sort of older, 11, 12 years old. I started to become quite angry about the fact that I didn't know who she was. And I felt some sort of connection to my birth mom in some way. And I wanted to see her. I wanted to see a picture of her at least. I knew I couldn't meet her. I used to run away all the time. So up until that point, I did used to run away. If I fell out and had an argument with my mum and dad, I would get my bags packed and go and walk along the A52 to try and find my mum.
Oh.
Hello.
So did you, at that age of 11, did you know anything about her, like her name, where
I knew
she
her
lived,
name, yeah, I knew her name
how
was,
old she was.
Yeah, I knew her name was Elizabeth. I knew she'd had me at 27 years old. I knew that she wasn't married to my father, and I knew that she was struggling to cope. So, but that I wasn't rejected, and like it was for my good that I was adopted. So it was quite a nice thing to know, because there's some you know, quite negative stories around adoption, and mine, what I was told. I guess I'd like to think I wouldn't have been told if it was negative, but I was told, and it was just that she, you know, she wasn't able to look after me.
Yeah, because I imagine finding out that you're adopted can give you lots of feelings of rejection and feeling like you weren't wanted, so you were given away. And is that something that you experienced yourself?
Well, it's like, it was almost like really good for me being in the foster environment, because out of all the children, bar their natural son, I was like theirs. So I was adopted. I had their name.
Okay.
And they chose me for their own. It doesn't mean they didn't choose the others. It's just that they chose to adopt a child, and that was me.
Mm.
So actually growing up, I felt special.
Okay.
Because I had their name. And, you know, the money that my mum spent was my mum and dad's money. It wasn't through social services money. It was like I was their own child. So I felt, although I wasn't their blood child. So that, I think that eased the bump of it, really.
And a credit to your adopted parents, because it sounds like the way that they went through the process and made you feel and made you clearly wanted within their family must have overcome any potential feelings of rejection that you might have had. So it sounds like the way that they mothered and fathered you and parented you.
Yeah.
Is that the right word?
Yeah, I think
parented. So. The way that they parented you was really good and helped you to get through that process.
Absolutely. Yeah, they did a great job. And they my mum was in a hairdresser before she adopted me, and she saw in a magazine that there was all these mixed race children that didn't really have anywhere to go because there wasn't many black parents adopting.
Okay.
And a lot of white people were adopting like white children. So it was for that reason that my mum adopted me.
Okay.
So she, you know, I was really given that, you know, that home because of the color of my skin, if that makes sense. So they really, they had it, you know, they had it mapped out to ensure that I was really made to feel at home. And I really did at home. It was only in later life, like most children, when they get to 11, 12, 13. My 11-year-old's now 13, really, okay. You know.
It's a tricky age, isn't it? It's a tricky age. I remember I went off the rails a little bit at that age as well. So when you were 11 and you decided that you wanted to find your mum, your biological mother, how did you go about trying to make that happen?
So I was in quite a good position because my mum was in touch with social services. Because she was a foster carer. So I asked my mom, please, I didn't ask her. She knew how desperate I was to see a picture. So she asked the social services if they could help to find me a picture of my birth mum, which was just amazing. I mean, I was so happy that my mom had done this for me. You know, and I had a particular lady that was on board with that, and she was going to go, and I can't remember whether I met her beforehand to talk about it. I can't remember, but anyway, there was this one woman called Sue who was a social worker, and her mission was to go and find me a picture of my mum. So I was so happy at that time. I was finally going to see a picture of her. And that, you know, I knew that was the most I was going to get, but at least then I'd be able to put a face to this, you know, definitely, this imaginary person that I came from.
Whoa, yeah, that makes a big difference.
And I really wanted
it?
That, so I could just have that for the rest of my time, just to be able to put a face to a name.
Okay, so did you get a photo?
I did. It was a very sad time. That was a very sad time. I remember the doorbell going and knowing that the meeting was happening and that there was some news.
Okay.
So my mum told me there's some news and Sue's coming back. So I was so excited. I mean, I remember when the doorbell went, the excitement. So that's how excited I remember it. It was so long ago.
Okay.
And we all went into the best room and sat down. And she said that they think they'd found my birth mum. But sadly, she's missing. And the only picture that she had of her was the newspaper clipping of her that they had of her missing. And so that in that meeting, that was the first photo that I saw of her, which was this greyed out. It was awful because it was this greyed out, horrible picture, really. With a very dark message with it as well, that this woman was missing. And I can't remember. It's all a bit of I think there was another meeting. I don't think it all happened on one meeting, but it's all a bit flaky in my mind. But I did find out either on that meeting or another meeting that my birth mum was dead and she'd been found at the bottom of a canal.
Oh, no.
So that picture was the only picture that I had of her for a fair few years after that. And also the knowing that she was no longer alive.
Wow. And that must have been really hard to take when you've really wanted something so much. And just when you get that first bit of information in that photo, then it comes with devastating news as well. How did that affect you?
So I now know that that was huge trauma. That was trauma. And trauma isn't necessarily what the actual event is. It's what happens after that event. And what happened after then was definitely trauma.
Okay.
Because I went, put it bluntly, I went off the rails. I mean, on that particular day, the meeting where I found out she was dead, I hugged the social worker, cried in the so. My mum and dad were sat there and I totally didn't have any contact with them.
Okay.
And that was because I blamed them. So I blamed my mum and dad for everything after that point. I was starting to blame them anyway up till that point because that's where I was. I was like, you know, I want to see my mum. You're not my real mum.
An angry teenager.
Why did you adopt me? And after that, I think it really was like, this is all your fault. you know, if you hadn't have adopted me, then maybe she wouldn't have died and I'd have been there with her and it's all your fault. And, you know, I was horrible, you know.
Okay.
I was hurting. I was in a lot of pain inside and I didn't know what to do with it. And I didn't know how to cope with this feeling because I felt as though I didn't belong anyway, being the colour of my skin. And now my birth mum was dead. So I felt, you know, I went off the rails in a big way after that. And a lot of things, events that happened with starting to drink, smoking, and all, were all a result of how I was feeling.
Mm.
I don't think I would have raided my mum and dad's drink cabinet the next year, in that year, had maybe that not have happened, you know. It was like I'm trying to numb out the pain.
Well, yeah, it's completely understandable because the emotions that you would have been feeling throughout that period, and they're not pleasant feelings by any stretch of the imagination. So a young girl in her early teenage years doesn't know how to process those things.
No.
So drinking alcohol is and going off the rails and getting into trouble is completely understandable, really.
I didn't really have anyone to talk to about it.
Okay.
You know, I think now the work I'm doing is I would want to talk to me almost immediately afterwards and get me to share how I feel about everything and get it out. And that's, but I never did that. Never got the chance to do that. So I think that's why the trauma just stuck with me and for a very long time.
So how long do you think it stayed with you for?
I'd say it's only been in the last 10 years where I feel I've been able to really understand the guilt and the shame and the issues that I've had with addictions in the last 10 years. So I think for a good 20 years.
And it's a long time to hold on to those kind of emotions. And I know from many conversations that we've had in the past about all of the work that you've been doing, the personal development and trying to understand and overcome these things. So what are the things that you've done over the last 10 years to try and deal with that trauma?
Well, mindfulness with you was brilliant. Yeah. I went to your mindfulness classes and then ended up working with you on them.
Yeah.
Mindfulness, meditation. I've been working on myself for a long time, like reading books, self-help books, development books, Louise Hay. There's a lot of I went on a retreat in 2001 in Thailand. Mm. I think that helped.
Okay.
So lots of little things I've been doing. To sort of, keep me all right.
Okay.
And it's I say in the last 10 years where I've actually started to be myself without that guilt and shame.
Mm.
And now I'm really working on my own experiences to help others.
Okay.
You know, because I feel I can do that now, but for a very, very long time, you're sort of stuck really with, you're stuck in your own guilt. You're stuck in your own shame. So you can read self-help books and you can be all right for a bit, but then it'll always kind of be there.
Yeah.
You know, you'll always, like, if you get a feeling or a trigger, you'll go for a glass of wine or a cigarette or whatever. It's always still there, you know. And I'd say it's only in the last 10 years where I've been aware of that.
Okay.
I'm working on that properly. Before, I've just been like, working on myself and what have you, but not really get into it. So
if there's someone watching or listening who has been through some kind of traumatic event in their lives and they are struggling to deal with it, what can they do to try and overcome it and get really deep into it, like you were saying?
Well, I'm currently doing a course with Gabor Maté, which is, and he's got the Wisdom of Trauma. So right now, I would love to maybe put in the comments later exactly what the answer to that question is, because I'm studying with him how to realise that the wisdom in the trauma, there is wisdom in the trauma that we experience at the time, but we don't realize it. The trauma is bad. And you think it's not bad, actually. It's not bad at all. What happened to me that day, me finding out, wasn't bad, was it? It was me, like, I was searching for truth. I was searching to find my birth mom, but it just turned out that she was dead. But because of that, I turned bad. You know, started drinking, smoking, being horrible to my mom and being bad. But the actual trauma wasn't bad.
Yeah.
And I think what we do is we, what happens after the traumatic event is we almost turn bad and believe we are bad. And I think the process of coming through it is realizing through real eyes that we're not bad and we never were bad in the first place. And then it's a healing process from there on. And I think it's about detaching from that badness because okay. for so long we feel that we are, you know, I felt like, oh, I'm really like bad, you know, but it's not that you are. And I think that's what people are carrying. They're carrying this weight of what's happened to them since. And if you can let go of that weight, which is like mindfulness.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the weight is in the head. A lot of the weight is the, is the, you know, it's all, it's not real, actually. We just think it is.
Well, and mindfulness is about recognizing what our thoughts are and accepting them for what they are, which is just thoughts, rather than letting our thoughts control who we are and what we do.
Yeah.
So that like detachment away from it is a really powerful skill to be able to develop, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's all in our head.
Mm.
And what I'm learning with trauma now with working as a coach and what have you is to sort of come out your head and come in here, come where we're alive. Because okay. it was there, it was in here, in this alive little spark that wanted to meet my mum. You know, that was a good feeling. That was a good feeling. So it's about connecting away from all this thought that's not real anyway to what's real in here. And then actually accepting yourself and realizing that all of those things that you did, okay, well, you know, we can move past that now and move forward without all of that baggage and badness because it didn't actually belong with you in the first place.
Yeah.
You were just never told that. You were just never told. I was, and a lot of us were just never actually told as children that actually none of this is your fault.
Yeah.
You know?
Because it's almost like a natural instinct to think that the things that happen to us are our fault.
Yeah.
And unless we have someone that we can talk to who tells us that it's not, then we carry that baggage around with us for a long time. And then it can affect our lives in lots of different ways. Like you said, bad behaviour or addictions and things like
well,
that.
Well, I left home. I ran away. Well, I didn't, but they knew where I was going. But I fell in love at 16. Yeah, I thought I had anyway at the time. And I left. I went to live in London for 5 years.
Okay.
Well, for a lot longer than that, actually. But I was in this relationship for 5 years and it wasn't love.
Okay.
And it wasn't nice. And actually, that relationship was a reflection of where I was at. You know, the things I was attracting and pulling to myself because of how bad I was feeling. And I really was feeling bad. So drinking, smoking, and falling in love with thinking I was falling in love with the right person who really wasn't. And he was a reflection of where I was at that time. It wasn't good.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting how that happens, isn't it? So after you found out that your birth mum had died, you then went through this period of going off the rails a little bit. You then went and tried to find the rest of your biological family.
No,
is that right?
No. So no. I was in London. I was 21.
Okay.
So I'd been with this man that I thought I loved, but quite soon realised I didn't. And it wasn't a healthy relationship at all. And I was trying to leave, but I was afraid to leave.
Okay.
But at 21, I went to the Children's Society, which is where this Sue worked in London.
Okay.
To find out about my mum. Like, why? How did she die? What okay. was her circumstances? Who was she? Tell me more, because I'm now old enough to find out. And that meeting changed my life.
Oh, wow.
That was a very big turning point. I found out it was like looking in a mirror at my birth mum, because everything I was going through in the relationship that I was in, that's what she was going through before she died.
Oh, right.
So she was in an abusive relationship. Now, it's an open verdict on whether she jumped or whether she got pushed, and we'll never know.
Oh, right.
But it's likely that she decided to end her life because of the situation she was in.
Yeah.
And it really was like I was in that at that time, but I never knew my birth mum.
Okay.
But yet I was looking at someone. It was crazy. And I found out about my birth father, found out his name. And most importantly, which changed my life, I found out I had a brother.
Oh, right.
So who was 2 years younger than me, same mum. So it meant the world that we came from the same place.
Yeah, definitely.
Different dad. As shallow as it may sound, it meant the world that he was the same colour as me.
Yeah, no, not at all, I think.
It meant the world.
Yeah.
Because that's all I wanted. I wanted a brother the same colour as me. So I got all of that and I just knew from that moment on that I was going to meet my brother and I was going to be the older sister. He was adopted as well when my birth mum died.
Okay.
So he actually lived with her. So knew a lot more than I did about her life.
Mm.
And yeah, I knew I had a brother. That's
and what was it like when you met him for the first time?
Out of this world. I remember when I was writing it in my book, writing the memories that are coming back of Digbeth coach station, because he lived in Birmingham. He's why I'm in Birmingham now.
Oh, right.
I was in London at the time.
Right.
Yeah. So he, it changed everything. It changed everything. Firstly, when I went home to my boyfriend at the time, I left without any fear. There was something around me that knew that I wasn't going to be in this relationship anymore. I had a brother. And I also knew that I wasn't going to go down this path anymore because it was the same path that my biological mum was had gone down.
Oh, right.
So, and for the first time, he just stepped to a side and let me go.
Oh,
whereas before, I was always afraid to leave. So there was something that shifted in me from that meeting. Very, very powerful. And it was in that year that I met him. So I was 21, he was 18, 19, and we met at Digbeth coach station. And and we're still very close now. It's beautiful. It's really, really good relationship.
So how long ago was that?
That was in, that was in 2003.
Okay.
Sorry, 1993.
Oh, wow. So that's coming up.
Oh, no, hang on. Not 99. I met my husband. Yeah, 93. Oh, time's going so quick. 93. Yeah.
So that's almost coming up to 30 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's like I've always known him. Yeah.
Did you feel like you had a connection together instantly?
Yeah. Yeah. And we look the same as well. So we've both got obviously our mother's face.
Okay.
We've both got the shape, the mouth, and yeah.
Why? It's amazing that you had such a traumatic experience as a child, but then that was replaced with this amazing experience when you were older.
Yeah. And also helped me to understand that my mum had done the right thing, giving me up for adoption.
Okay.
And it's a shame, really, that she didn't give my brother up for adoption as well, because he had to endure and see. And thankfully, he was adopted at 9 by a great couple that really worked with him, and he's all right. But it was damaged, you know.
And are there other members of the family that you've met?
So that was it then.
Okay.
From there is another brother, but I don't talk about him.
Okay.
That's another story. And I will write about that one day. I will write about that.
So yeah, let's go on to the writing that you've done.
Yeah.
Because you've written a book. Can you tell me what the book is about?
So the book is Lost and Found.
Okay.
So I've talked about feeling lost, feeling like I didn't belong. And the found, the start of the found, is what I've just shared with you there with my brother. But then something really strange happened. And it was, the strange thing is, when I met my brother, we also, there was a mutual friend that we had called Tracy, mm-hmm. that I became closer to as the years went by. And in 2005, so what, I've known my brother 12 years now, and she goes to London to get her, goes to university in London.
Okay.
And she comes back and she's going out with someone. I know she's going out with someone because I've heard she's going out with some kind of promoter guy in London or whatever. Hmm. Anyway, I get a phone call from my brother asking me to come to the pub because Tracy's there. And I was like, okay. And it was really strange because I felt like a need to get there really quickly.
Okay.
Honestly, I felt like I've got to get there really quickly. I actually felt like I was putting my foot down on the M6 to get to Erdington, which is where the pub was.
Okay.
And I remember walking in the pub, and I remember this absolutely everything. Walking in the pub, there was my brother at the bar. And the first thing I said was, where's Tracy? And he says, well, she's in the toilet. So instead of just standing and waiting, I went to the toilet. And we embraced in the toilet. Okay. Which is really bizarre. I could have waited, but there is a reason for all of this.
Okay.
And I believe there's something more to this. And anyway, within about 5 minutes of her coming out of, us both coming out of the toilet together, she's showing me a picture of her boyfriend on the phone.
Okay.
And then the next thing she says is, Donna, I've just been to meet a week or so ago, his older sister. She's got exactly the same mannerisms as you. It's really strange. And I was like, oh, right, okay, whatever. And then she mentions another girl's name called Veronica. Now, what I haven't said in my story is when I used to go out in this time where I was in pain and hurting because of the trauma, I used to go out a lot younger than I should have done into town drinking. And there was this girl called Veronica that always I got mistaken for, and she did as well.
Okay.
So I remember this name, Veronica, and her name was Veronica Mead.
Okay.
Now, Mead was the surname that my father, I was told in that meeting that my biological father's name was Mead.
Oh, right.
And so when I'm talking to Tracy in the pub, she mentions this girl, Veronica, as well in this same conversation. Okay. So my head's going now and I'm thinking Veronica Mead. And I'm thinking my father's name is Mead. And then it comes back to me that me and Veronica used to get mistaken for each other. So I said to her, oh my gosh, find out what his dad's name is.
Okay.
Is his name what it is? And she went off into the toilet, phoned him, came back, white as a sheet, and said, yeah, that's his father.
Wow.
So I found out that night in that pub who my father was.
Wow.
It's explained beautifully in the book. So it's, yeah.
And Veronica is your half-sister.
Veronica is my sister, okay. Yeah. And Sylvia, the sister that she went to that had the same mannerisms as me, is my sister. I've also got another younger sister, Melinda, and I've got four brothers. So there's eight of us in total.
Wow.
I found out that my biological father had died. This was in 2006, and he died in the year 2000.
Okay.
Which is sad because obviously I'll never meet him. But I found out some wonderful things about him.
that's such a coincidental way to discover. How many siblings?
Seven.
Seven siblings.
And my father had 16 brothers and sisters.
Oh, wow.
So I've got lots of aunties and uncles, lots of cousins. Wow. You know my dream?
Yeah.
Wanting to be in a family the same colour as me? Well, I've got like the Cosby family like 10 times over.
That's so wonderful to hear that story and how it happened, and that your dream of having that family is now realised.
Yeah.
Are you close with all of those other siblings as well as your brother?
Especially my sisters.
Okay.
Yeah, we've been to Amsterdam, we've been to Barcelona, we've been to Jamaica. I didn't know where my father was from. I didn't know whether he was obviously originally from Africa, but I didn't know whether he was from Jamaica, Barbados or wherever. And but I found out he was from Jamaica. And so we all went to Jamaica 2 years ago for a cousin's wedding. And that was special. We get on really well.
Isn't the tattoo something to do with them as well?
Yeah, so the tattoo is our initials, Silver, Veronica, Melinda, Donna, and Veronica D designed this, and we've all got the same tattoo, albeit different areas. It's my, and I always said for years, my husband's got tattoos, and he's like, come on, get one. I'm like, I won't get one until it means something really important or special. Well, that was my first one, and probably be my last one, to be honest.
Well, it's nice that it's a tattoo with real meaning and real depth to it.
Yeah.
So the book that you've written, is that available for people to buy?
It's going to be available from the 24th of July.
Okay.
So I can leave a link or whatever in the notes for you. So it's not our launch is, we haven't launched yet. We're launching on the 24th of July, and that's when the book will be available. So, but I am taking... But you can buy it now, but you just won't get it until after the 24th. Okay. So.
Well, yeah, we'll definitely leave the links to that. I'm sure that it's a fascinating read. The process for you of writing it, was that quite therapeutic as well?
It was the hardest thing I've had to do.
Oh, wow.
And I now know why I never wrote before, because it was always for myself, writing a book or whatever, and I'd self-criticise it and think, oh, it's rubbish, and throw it away. Mm. This was for someone else. It was for me. It's my chapter, but it was for someone else's book. So it's an anthology called New Women. And I knew that if I didn't do it, I wouldn't be in that book. There'd be 32 authors, not 33. I missed the deadline.
All right.
And I phoned the lady and I said, the author, and I said, I can't do this. And she said, you can. She says, I'll give you 2 more days. I said, can you give me 4? She said, no. So I had to do it. And it was the hardest thing I had to do. And I realised why, because I was afraid.
Okay.
I was afraid of going deep.
Wow. Reliving all of those experiences effectively.
Yeah. And what I was up till 4 in the morning, one of the mornings over the 2 days. But I did it.
And did you find the process of doing it, did it help to relieve some of those emotions away?
It helped me, yeah. And it helped me understand why, because I've reading a lot of biographies and they're talking about their childhood. I'm like, how do you remember all of this? But when you start writing, the whole exercise and experience, it comes back to you.
Mm.
I remember leaving Digbeth coach station with my brother and us seeing one of those old style policemen with the police proper hat on a bicycle. And it was like, it came back to me and us both looking at each other. And that was like when we had like one of our first connections. It was like, we were like, what is going on? We're connected on this. But it came back to me when I was writing. Okay. So nice things as well as not so nice things came back. And I think it was because I was afraid. I was afraid to go too deep.
Yeah, and it is hard to relive those kind of things. I want to find out more about the podcast that you do now. How long have you been doing it for, and what is the purpose of the podcast?
So Searching for Truth is my podcast, and it started in August last year. So I was doing loads of children's parties. They all cancelled in March because of the lockdowns COVID, and stuff for COVID. So all my parties, I started doing virtual parties, which is great. I'm really excited about what I can do with these virtual parties now. I would never have experienced that before, but podcast. I did an interview with the CEO of my children's, one of the children's entertainment companies I work for. And he said, Donna, you'd be really good at doing a podcast. Deep down, I knew I wanted to do one. And I think I'd spoken to you about it.
Yeah, I remember having that.
Conversation. Yeah. So I knew it was something I wanted to do. And I just finally did it. And I wanted it to be a reflection of my story and my stuff, so I could really get into conversations with my guests about it, but it not be about me. So it's searching for truth around adoption, around fostering, around domestic violence and abuse, and all areas of my life that were a part of my life. But I wanted to share. I didn't want to just get on in front of a mic and just blah about me. I wanted it to be a discussion with others. And that's what it is. And I've had some really good feedback from both the guests who have said in a very nice, safe way, they've untangled a lot of sort of stuff they didn't even realise was still there just through talking about it. Because that is the best healer. When I met you first as a speaker, learning to be a speaker, for me, that was the start of my real healing journey, I think, speaking my truth, getting it out. It doesn't belong in here, it belongs out. Because not only does it not belong in here, it can help so many others if it comes out from you because you've been there. And So yeah, it was. It's a podcast. It's not about me, but I can relate to a lot of the things in there.
It sounds like a really valuable podcast to be putting out there for the people that are coming on as guests, so they can talk about their experience, but also for the people that are listening as well, because so many of us do go through traumatic experiences in our lives, and being able to hear other people talking about theirs helps us realise that we're not alone, and just that can help people to feel better. And also if they can learn from other people's experiences with things that they've done to get through and heal and overcome those traumatic experiences, it sounds like a fantastic podcast and something that can bring a lot of value to other people's lives.
Yeah, well, I'm now working as a childhood trauma coach, so I'm working with adults that are ready to be rid of that attachment to that trauma once and for all. Because, and I actually do believe, me and other people I've worked with, the potential that people have got, you know, once you've gotten rid of that and you realise it never belonged to you in the first place, the potential they've got to help others is immense. And yeah, so that's what I'm going to be focusing more of my podcast on now.
Okay. So with the coaching that you're doing, how did you get into becoming a coach in the first place?
So I believe the speaking came first.
Okay.
So when I met you as a speaker, and then, do you know what? I think it's always been in there. Like when I was a young, you know, when people say, what did you want to be when you wanted to grow up when you were younger? I wanted to be like a social worker or a prison officer, or I always wanted to be of service.
Okay.
So I think coaching, helping, mentoring, supporting was always going to be something that I was going to do.
Yeah.
And I think it was the speaking that I started first. Once I started speaking my story out and I started to feel healing from that, then the next thing is like, right, I want to help others. I want to help others do something. So coaching just became a natural thing for me to start looking into.
Yeah. And from me knowing you over quite a long period of time now and knowing your personality, I think being a coach is absolutely perfect for you to do, because I know that you're a very kind and caring person and you're always looking to help other people. And with the experiences that you've had yourself, then you can really empathize and understand where people are coming from, and you can actually give them advice from your own experience.
And the great thing is now online, you know, you can work with people all over the world. You know, you're not just limited to where you are located. So I'm excited about the amount of being a good coach so that people can get coached and move on quickly and, you know, just, and get more people speaking, healing, coaching themselves. Because they are the best people to be doing it. People that have actually experienced this. You know, people that are going through it will sit and talk to someone who's been through it themselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to kind of get that momentum going, so it's exciting. And it makes it all worthwhile. You know, I would never want to go back and relive it all again. But then at the same time, I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't change a thing. Like you asked the question, if I did get it, was if I was in a black family growing up.
Yeah.
I wouldn't change a thing. There's a lot of other things that did happen in my childhood as well, which I haven't discussed here and I haven't discussed in the book, and I will do one day. But I wouldn't change anything because it has made me who I am today.
Yeah, absolutely. There's things that happen to us which we think are good and we think are bad, and other stuff that's in the middle, but they all shape us into the people that we are. So really, none of those things are good or bad. They're just experiences that develop us as people.
Yeah.
So I've got one final question for you now, which is, what is your tagline for the episode?
Lost and found. My story is Lost and Found, a story of faith, love and forgiveness. I don't know if you can have all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really nice, because Lost and Found is your story, and that's the name of the chapter in that book.
Yeah.
And what's the last bit?
So a story of faith, love and forgiveness. Okay. So that's what it is. The story is lost and found, but it's a story of faith, love and forgiveness, because all those three, I had love. And without that, I honestly feel, without that love from the very start of being adopted, unconditional. Right now, my parents are still alive. You know, we're back on track.
Okay, that's good.
And faith, belief, not necessarily faith, the religious faith, because I didn't have that for a long time, but just faith in, I never stopped believing, you know, okay. I never stopped believing. And that was a big part of my story. And forgiveness, you know, I've forgiven. I used to have a lot of around my birth mom for a long time. Okay. You know, it went from my adopted mom to my birth mom. How could you give me up? You know, and how could you die? How could you do this to me? And even my abusive ex-boyfriend, you know,
okay.
Forgiveness is really important to be able to move on from trauma and let go and just be the best version of yourself. You got to let go and forgive.
And I think also forgiving ourselves as well.
Massively. Mm. Yeah, massive. That's a huge one. Forgiving and accepting who you are.
Yeah.
And so it's lost and found, story of faith, love and forgiveness.
Awesome. I love it. Well, Donna, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your story. It really has been really fascinating to hear about all of those things that have happened to you and the way that they've shaped you into who you are. And now all of the exciting things that you're doing with your life. So I wish you all the best of luck for the future with everything that you do.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks to Donna again for coming on along. If you did like this episode, then please do give us a like and subscribe so you don't miss out on future content. We'll be here again next week with a new guest, so please make sure you tune in and I'll see you there.